Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. With unemployment stuck at over 9%, that may be you struggling to decide whether to hang on to your rung on the ladder and wait for a job as good as the last one, or to take a lower wage job, a low wage job, if you can find it, and at least have a job. It's one thing for an individual to decide. It's another for a country. This hour on Point, low wage work and the American jobs crisis. You can join the conversation. Is it time to take what we can get? Can that be a national strategy, your strategy? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. It's been out there as an issue for a while. Rick Perry, governor of Texas, jumping into the presidential nomination race in the GOP, has put it front and center. Last week, NBC's Brian Williams, as moderator, kicked off a GOP debate at the Reagan Library in California with a question for Texas Governor Rick Perry on his state's jobs record.
Governor Perry, we're going to begin with you. You're the newcomer here on stage. You probably saw this coming a mile away. You have touted your state's low taxes, the lack of regulation, tough tort reform as the recipe for job growth in the Lone Star State. But Texas ranks last among those who have completed high school. There are only 8 other states with more living in poverty. No other state has more working at or below the minimum wage. So is that the kind of answer all Americans are looking for?
Actually, what Americans are looking for is someone can get this country working again. And we put the model in place in the state of Texas. When you look at what we have done over the last decade, we created 1 million jobs in the state of Texas. Same time, America lost 2.5 million. So I will suggest to you that Americans are focused on the right issue, and that is who on this stage can get America working, because we know for a fact the resident of the White House cannot.
But you know by now the counter argument to that is the number of low wage jobs and the fact that unemployment is better in over half the states of the union than it is right now in Texas.
Well, the first part of that comment is incorrect, because 95% of all the jobs that we've created have been above minimum wage. So I'm proud of what we've done in the state of Texas. And for the White House or anyone else to be criticizing creation of jobs now in America, I think is a little bit hypocritical.
A little bit hypocritical. We're going to go to Texas in this hour and look at the jobs picture there, what's been created, what hasn't, how the wages look in Texas. But we're going to look at this grand scale as well. Joining me in the studio right now is Paul Osterman, professor of human resources and management at MIT's Sloan School of Management. He's co-author of Good Jobs America, Making Work Better for Everyone. His column, The Challenge of Creating Good Jobs, appeared in the New York Times last Thursday. Paul Osterman, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
So there's the Texas model, and Governor Perry says 95% of those jobs above minimum wage, but they're tied for dead last in the country with Mississippi for low wage jobs. Is that what we need to do in this country? They've created much more than low wage jobs. Let's note all kinds of other jobs as well, but plenty of low wage in there, and they rank certainly low when it comes to wages in this country. He says Americans are looking for someone who can get this country working again. Is low wage jobs what that means?
So I want to be clear. This is not a discussion about whether an individual, if he or she is unemployed and is faced with a choice, should or should not take a job if it's offered. That's not what this discussion is about. I would never tell somebody, go on welfare, don't let your kids eat, don't turn down a job.
But you put hundreds of millions of those together and you've got a national policy picture strategy.
Right.
That's
what we're looking at. We're looking at the national question. And what I want to push on is a couple of points. First, I want to push on the fact that I don't think it's a trade-off. We don't face as a country a choice between quality and quantity.
Of jobs if
we adopt the right policies. Secondly, I want to be clear what the consequences of a low-wage job strategy are. Those are consequences of health care, people foregoing. I mentioned, for example, in the discussion of Texas, people foregoing treatment for type 2 diabetes and a decade later losing an arm or a leg, going blind, not being able to attend your kids' after-school program, not being able to go to parent-teacher conferences.
Because you're in a low-wage job with no flexibility and you need every penny of that work week.
Absolutely. So there's terrible consequences. many people think that low-wage jobs are the first step on a ladder, that there's a lot that we – this is Horatio Alger. There's a lot of upward mobility. The data do not support that. People are trapped – adults, not kids. Adults are trapped in these low-wage jobs. Now, be clear. We're not talking about kids here. We're talking about adults.
Yep.
So it's a and finally, lots of Americans who hold good jobs are at risk of falling into this low-wage job sector if they lose work. So it's a significant problem. But the key point I want to make to you, and we can talk about it, is that we really don't face a trade-off. We could adopt policies that, in some sense, let us have both quantity and quality of work.
We don't face a trade-off, and yet people look out at the global labor picture and say, you know, the sort of base wages are lower in so many countries around the world that we are now competing directly with. We had Bill Gross here on here last week, big investor from PIMCO, and he said, you know, oh, no, I'm afraid we may have to notch it down in this country, notch it down to compete and win back some of that work.
Well, that's easy for Bill Gross to say.
He makes
quite a bit of money, so he's comfortable with notching it down. I think that we do face a challenge from the global labor market. There's no question that that's true. But again, the issue is how you respond. So you respond by educating your workforce, by moving up the food chain in terms of job quality, not by dumbing down work and moving down the food chain.
Yeah, we put that to him, and he said, you know, because that's what we've been told for years in this country. Free trade's good because, I mean, it's good because it builds all the economy around the world, and we move on up the ladder. He wasn't so sure that's actually going to happen. Are you absolutely confident that we can all move up that ladder? We're not doing it right now, and a lot of people are out of work.
So, look, there's two issues here. One is kind of the macro economy. Why is unemployment at 9% today? And the answer is there's inadequate demand. The president proposed a jobs plan, which is a good step in the right direction. It's not going to solve the problem because it's too small. He faces significant political constraints. So there's a macroeconomic question. Getting more demand into the economy, getting more money flowing, hiring more people. And then there's the question you're also asking, the deeper, harder question, which is once we're at full employment, what does that look like? Is that a full employment of McDonald's jobs and low-wage work, or is that a full employment of good work? Those are two separable questions.
Let's go to Texas and see what things look like there. Don Baylor joins us right now. He's in Milwaukee today, but he's senior policy analyst at the Austin, Texas-based Center for Public Policy Priorities, an eighth-generation Texan. Don Baylor, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Rick Perry is proud of his jobs creation record in Texas. He talks about it every time he gets in on the stump. And right now, Americans do care a lot about jobs. Give us a picture, a profile of the jobs that have been created in Texas. Is it fair to say that a big chunk of what he's brought there has been low wage? And is that welcome or is that a problem?
Well, thank you very much, Tom, again. And I just want to kind of lay out a few facts that we've been able to discern when looking at the Texas labor market now and over time. So first of all, Texas is by and large not bucking many of the national trends. So number one, wages are flat overall, especially in the private sector. Number two, construction and manufacturing, which are traditionally higher wage and also traditionally entry points into the middle class, are shrinking in Texas just like everywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Our unemployment rate is extremely high by historical standards. We've had 23 straight months of over 8%. And in fact, we're one of only a dozen states in which the unemployment rate has actually continued to climb since the end of the official recession. And lastly, one of the things I don't think people realize is what a big role that the public sector has played in net job creation in Texas. So over the last 4 years, even though the public sector is only about 17% of the overall labor force, they've created about 60% of the jobs in Texas. And that goes to a variety of reasons, including our rapid population growth. And so those are some of the things that we want to make sure that listeners really understand about this so-called Texas miracle.
What about wages, Don? Rick Perry points to his record. Since he became governor in the year 2000, Texas has added more than 1 million jobs. The country lost 1.3 million. What about wages within those 1 million jobs? What's the profile? How does it compare to the national profile?
Well, the trend is pretty clear. We actually graphed this on Friday, and we looked at, in particular, the share of hourly workers that are making minimum wage or less. And as you mentioned at the top of the broadcast, Texas shares that distinction with Mississippi for having the highest share, just below about 10% of all hourly workers. And I think what's really interesting in that is the trend. And so we have outgained, so to speak, all of our neighbors. So
in what?
In the share of low-wage jobs over the last 5 to 6 to 7 years. So we were about eighth from the bottom, so to speak, about 6 or 7 years ago. And in fact, we've actually shot past all of our neighbors, Oklahoma, Arkansas, New Mexico, and Louisiana.
You say shot past, but you mean shot past on the downward direction.
On the downward, yeah, in terms of the race to the bottom.
Rick Perry might say, look, we've got a big border with Mexico, and along that border, we're right up against the Mexican economy, and of course there are some low-wage jobs there, so but we should be happy to have those jobs on that border.
Well, if I could comment on that, yes or no?
Well, let me get Don first, sure. Just for a second here. Don, what do you think about that argument?
Well, I think once again, I don't think it's really about I don't think it's really about that type of Hobbesian choice. I think that by and large, we are going to see a certain amount of low wage jobs. That's just part of the game. But when you look at the trends are not very good. So really, the only high wage industry that appears to be growing in Texas is natural resources and mining. That's only about 4% of the labor force.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about low-wage work and America's unemployment crisis, asking if we're headed down the wage scale. And is that Rick Perry's Texas model? Should that be something we look at for the whole country, one by one, collectively? Paul Osterman is with us from MIT's Sloan School of Management, co-author of Good Jobs America. And Don Baylor is with us from the Austin, Texas-based Center for Public Policy Priorities. President Obama was thinking about international competition and wage pressure when he talked about his new jobs package to Congress last week.
We now live in a world where technology has made it possible for companies to take their business anywhere. If we want them to start here and stay here and hire here, we have to be able to outbuild and out-educate and out-innovate every other country on earth.
That's what has to be done. And race to the bottom, no thank you, said the president.
We shouldn't be in a race to the bottom where we try to offer the cheapest labor and the worst pollution standards. America should be in a race to the top, and I believe we can win that race.
That's the race Americans did win and long been told they would win again. But what's the reality here? What are we looking at? Paul Osterman, a lot of response online here. Here's a listener on Facebook. Eric says, welcome to the entitlement mentality society. We are not entitled to high-wage jobs just because we think we should be making more. Having a lower-wage job is better than having no job at all. Quit complaining.
Well, let me say, if you're an individual and you're faced with the choice of not working or working, I can't disagree with you, Eric. But that's not the choice we face as a country. So look, on the international question, Germany and France, those are two countries who are in the same international market that we compete with.
Mm-hmm.
Both countries have fewer low-wage jobs as a proportion of the workforce than we do and have a higher percentage of their adults working than we do. So they've figured out a way to do this. So how do you do this?
Yes.
So let's look at Texas as an example, actually.
Mm-hmm.
In the valley, in the Rio Grande Valley, where I talked about in the op-ed in the New York Times.
Along the Mexican border,
along the Mexican
obviously.
Border, mm-hmm. A community organization engaged in a living wage campaign. They raised the wages of public workers who were in the school districts, who were in the cafeterias, who were doing the lawn work in the schools. They were working at minimum wages. They raised the wages through living wages. That's standards. Standards, good standards are one strategy. Job training and skills is the other strategy. Again, in Texas, there's a network of training programs, Project Quest in San Antonio, VITA in the Valley, Capital ID in Austin, that are very effective in upgrading low-wage workers into high-quality jobs. The problem is, as a country, we haven't committed to these strategies. We haven't committed to real labor standards, and we haven't committed to real investments in workers.
Well, let's go back to the first one, though. You're talking public workers there. There you can wave a wand. As long as you've got, you know, somebody will lend you the money to pay it, you can pay those wages.
So,
but what about in private industry where there's competition?
Okay, so a typical low-wage job in private industry might be cleaning hotel rooms,
okay,
right?
Yep.
So if you clean your hotel room in Las Vegas, you make about $14 an hour plus benefits. If you clean a hotel room in New Orleans, you make about $9 an hour and very few benefits.
That's because Vegas was unionized.
That's right. So what I'm telling you, and there's no evidence that there's costing employment, by the way. So what I'm telling you is we do have choices. There's policy solutions. One set of policy solutions is our labor market standards. Another is employee voice. Another is job training and skills. Those are choices that other countries, developed countries, France and Germany, have made. We haven't made those choices. Those are choices that work in Texas when they're tried.
Don Baylor, what do you think? Why has Texas got this high level of low-wage jobs? Is it part of the strategy there? Is it the approach? Is it just because Texas sits next to Mexico in its economy?
We also shouldn't forget that Texas is also part of the Deep South, and the Deep South has historically had a record of suppressing unionization and wages. So we should not forget that Texas is part and has contributed to this legacy over the past several decades. But going back, and I do want to thank you for mentioning education, because by and large, our labor market does reflect the educational attainment of the workforce in Texas. So you mentioned before about Texas leads the U.S. in terms of the share of folks that have not finished a high school degree. So about 1 in 5 Texans in the workforce have not finished a high school degree. That's compared to about 1 in 8 the U.S. And also the same for college. We have much fewer folks that have actually finished an associate's degree or 2-year degree. And as we know, the more you learn, the more you earn. And so by and large, we have a relatively undereducated population that has not been able to command higher wages. And so to the degree that you are okay with a high high school dropout rate, you're going to have a large share of minimum wage jobs. And we have not committed to investing in our K-12 public education and our higher education to make sure that more Texans finish high school and finish college.
So there's a kind of cycle here. Is that the difference between the U.S., Paul, and Germany and France? Is it on the education front that lets them, hover at a higher altitude there?
So take Germany as an example. Every high school kid in Germany either goes to university, or virtually every high school kid either goes to university or goes into a high-quality apprenticeship program where they spend a couple of years working part-time at a firm and a part-time staying in school. Much more effective. There's no question that Don's right, that if we invest in people, that will lead to improved jobs. But we also need standards. We also need other strategies. But education and training is key. And for the adults who are out there now who aren't going to go back to high school, we do have, as I mentioned, this network of programs and others like them around the country. We do have strategies for upgrading the skills of adults if we're willing to make that investment. It's a choice.
And if you can find a job when you upgrade, let's hear more from Texas. Austin, Texas, Erica Greeter is with us. She's a correspondent there for The Economist magazine. Erica Greeter, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
All kinds of jobs in Texas, but they lead the country in low-wage jobs tied with Mississippi from what we're looking at here. Should we bemoan this, or is Rick Perry right? Hey, don't sniff at a job when unemployment's so high in this country.
I think it's a really worthwhile conversation to have, and I'm glad we're having it, but I'm not sure we're in a position to be really snooty about the jobs we're creating in Texas or in the country. But with regard to Texas specifically, I wanted to say that I'm not sure I agree with the premise that the situation is that much worse here than it is in other states. A lot of the jobs created have been pretty good. Most of them are above minimum wage, and even in the minimum wage space, Texas isn't that far from the national norm. So, of course, in real numbers, there's a lot of minimum wage workers in Texas. As a share of the workforce, as you mentioned, we're tied with Mississippi, about 9.5%
for
of
last.
Workers are making
mm-hmm.
of – sorry?
For last
yeah,
in
for
the
last.
Country.
And that's 9.5% of hourly workers. Mm-hmm. In terms of hourly workers, it's about 56% of working Texans are hourly workers mm-hmm. compared to about 59% nationally. I think nationally the average is about 6% of hourly workers are minimum wage or lower.
So, I mean, we get it. And there are a lot of jobs in here that created during the Perry years that aren't by no means, they're not minimum wage. They're much higher than minimum wage. But these percentages, these margins matter. I mean, do you see a model in Texas, Erica, for the country, or would that mean just notching up the portion of Americans in lower, low-wage jobs?
I guess I wouldn't characterize it as a low-wage job strategy. I think it's a more general create all the jobs you can strategy. And with the focus from state policy, what we've seen has been to the extent that they're steering job creation, they're steering things in certain industries and in you know, white-collar jobs, professional business services, and that kind of thing. So of the about 300,000 jobs created in Texas since the end of the recession, which was officially in June 2009, mm-hmm. You have about one-sixth of those in natural resources, oil and gas, which is always a boon to the state. Mm-hmm. You have about 90,000 in education and health services, which is pretty closely tied to population growth in the state. And you have about 75,000, so about a quarter of those, in professional and business jobs. Another about 45,000 in government, again tied to population growth.
Paul Osterman with me here in the studio. We heard from Bob Reich, former labor secretary, last week saying, look, we don't have the option as a country to go to a lower wage profile because the whole economy breaks down. The economy depends on people out there, you know, buying things and exercising their affluence. That's what an affluent economy – we don't have this option, he said.
But. Well, that's right. I mean, that's how we got out of the Great Depression, by increasing demand. If demand is low, if people are poor, they don't buy things. But Erica makes an interesting point. She says, look, you're talking about hourly wage jobs, this minimum wage percentage, and we've got a lot of salary jobs and so on. What's the national number? So in this book that you mentioned,
Good Jobs America, your book with Beth Shulman.
Right. Yep. In that book, I look at among all adult Americans, mm-hmm. what percentage are in poverty level wages? That means what percentage are in jobs that pay a wage that would not raise a family of four above the poverty level,
okay.
Right?
Yep.
20%. One out of five American adults, hourly workers, salary workers, everyone, is in a poverty-level job. That's just unacceptable, in my view.
Okay, but let's really get down to it here then. If we're really in some kind of terrible global competition here, you know, you have now, the Heritage Foundation came out recently with some of their people, a statement saying, look, poverty isn't so bad in America. People have air conditioning, they've got cars, you know, we call it poverty level, but if we have to dig down and compete at this level to get back in the game, that's just what we've got to do.
Well, look, so you say that to someone who's in poverty, who can't.
I'm not, but it's being said.
But people say all kinds of things.
Yep.
But that person can't get health care. That person can't go to their kid's teacher conference. That family suffers. That family often divorces. There's all kinds of problems that come out of poverty. So it's easy for the Heritage Foundation to say it's comfortable. It's not comfortable for the people who are living it.
Let's go to our listeners. Jackson, Kentucky. Len is calling. Hi, Len. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking the call. A couple things. I work as a biomedical equipment technician. We fix hospital equipment.
Yep.
And I was out of work for 51 weeks, and I was up against this decision of, do I continue my career? I can't find one. Or do I take a job as a used car salesman? I found this job down in Kentucky. I moved out of state. Took a $15,000 a year pay cut in order to continue my career. And I'm thankful for my start in the career. And one of the points I wanted to make was that the government had, for military people coming out when I got out of the Army in 1980, a six-month program where the government would pay half the salary for training that individual. I think they should do that with our veterans now, and maybe we get more people into a career. Thanks to that program, I'm in 30 years experience of taking care of hospital equipment.
Let me ask you, though, Lynn, what is your expectation at this point? You took a $15,000 pay cut. Do you think you'll work back to a better wage as the economy improves, or are you kind of resigning yourself to this as your new wage level?
I think this is the new normal. I mean, granted, I have a little bit less responsibilities in terms of amount of things I have to do, but within the industry, I'm on the low end of scale of the of pay within electronic repair in
yep.
the industry.
Yeah. On the low end and seeing it as the new normal, and that can't be fun. But we wish you luck with it, Lynn, and I appreciate your call. I've got a lot more here. Bill in Dubuque, Iowa. Bill, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I got laid off probably about 2 months ago from a manufacturing job. I was making about $15 an hour.
Okay.
And, You know, I'm not opposed to taking a lower paying job. I mean, I wasn't making a whole lot to begin with, I guess. But what scares me is this talk of new normal. And if prices, you know, the cost of living doesn't drop to allow me to live, you know, at a lower wage, then I'm going to be in poverty, you know, if I don't get a better paying job. And that's kind of what scares me about it.
Right. It's one thing if it's a rung on a ladder, you got to put your foot down for a minute to push back up. But what if that doesn't happen? Bill, I appreciate your call and I wish you luck. One more here. Jackie. Thank you, Bill. Brattleboro, Vermont. Jackie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I'm noticing that those of us who are making $10 an hour, which is like above the minimum, but it's still barely livable.
Yeah.
We're being asked to take a cut by the same folks who are fighting tooth and nail against removing the tax breaks that they've been given on their high salaries. What do they make? $200 an hour? $2,000 an hour?
And right on up.
We're asked to take a cut. And right on up, I know. It's like appalls me to say more than $2,000 an hour. So, I mean, this is what I say. Why are you putting us in this position where we're being asked this? Lower your own profits. Lower your own salaries. And pay your taxes.
Yeah, Jackie, I appreciate...
you're going to be making...
Yeah, all that money and then resisting but saying, well, maybe that's what we've got to do. Don Baylor, is there resistance to this in Texas? Or is there an embrace because, you know, by golly, these are jobs. These are incomes.
Well, I think one of the ironies about kind of the rising share of low-wage jobs, and I agree with Erica, this is certainly not an intentional strategy to create a lot of minimum wage jobs. But the irony is that the more of those jobs that you have, the more need you actually have for government assistance. So to the degree that folks do not earn enough to put food on the table, that means that we have to, that more folks have to rely on food assistance. This is also the same thing for health insurance as well. And so, you know, what we think is kind of a strategy that's worth pursuing ends up, I think, probably costing us more in the long term. And I think that's probably the damage from such a type of a low road approach is that you end up actually costing the taxpayers and the government a lot more if folks are not able to be self-sufficient.
Erica, what about it? Net-net. Well, look at the country, but does it work for Texas? I mean, they've got 1 in 4 with no health insurance, highest rate in the country. When they get sick, somebody pays for that. Does it pay for Texas to carry this, you know, higher than the average, than the mean low-wage workforce?
No, clearly it's not ideal. You know, in hearing the callers, one thing that kind of struck me is that I agree with Paul and with Don that it's not really we're not really facing this choice between create awesome jobs or create mediocre jobs. There's actually some concern, I think, about whether we still have the capacity to create lower wage jobs. We've seen a lot of outsourcing in areas like manufacturing. That's one thing that's hit Texas actually pretty hard. That sector has lost jobs in the state. And we're seeing some more outsourcing or relocation of jobs that used to be kind of entry-level or low-wage services that are being automated or consolidated. So, as a general point, I think we're not in a position to just kind of scoff at jobs as we get them. But yes, clearly, going forward, it's better to have jobs that provide enough resources for people to provide health care and so on for themselves and their families.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about low-wage work and America's unemployment crisis, asking if we're headed down the wage scale. Should we be? Paul Osterman is with us from MIT's Sloan School of Management, co-author of Good Jobs America. Don Baylor's here. He is with the Austin, Texas-based Center for Public Policy Priorities. And Erica Greeter's with us, Southwest correspondent based in Texas as well, Austin, for The Economist magazine. We've been looking at Rick Perry because he's been prominent in the last week and talking a lot about job creation. But it's not just the Texas governor who has been associated with, well, let's not sniff at low-wage jobs. Last week we had on the co-founder of the world's biggest bond fund, Bill Gross of PIMCO. And he as much as said that in the globalized world we, the U.S., created, it's rendered a lot of good-paying American jobs obsolete.
there's a global revaluation in terms of wages in developed versus developing, and to the extent that the developing world, you know, works for much cheaper than the developed world at $30, $40, or $50 an hour, basically has to adjust lower in terms of those levels. And so the combination of technology and globalization is basically eroding our labor base here in the United States and, frankly, in other developed countries.
Eroding our labor base, by which he means our wages. But as Paul Osterman points out, we've got some other developed countries doing a little better than we are on that front. Richard calling from Essex, New York. Richard, thanks very much. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I work in higher education, but I think what's happening where I work is a reflection of exactly this economic. I'm an adjunct faculty.
Okay.
I teach more than the load of a full-time faculty member, and I get $2,500 a course. So for teaching eight courses, when a normal full-time faculty teaches six, I earn less than half the lowest paid lectureship. And in my department, that's 40% of the course load for undergraduates.
Adjunct professor there, what does that mean in terms of what you take home, Richard?
Well, I take home $20,000 a year, which puts me below the poverty level. I have a family of four. I need, people may say this is meant to be a part-time job, except that if universities are relying on 40%, and some universities as much as 70% that I've worked at.
And you're teaching eight courses. That doesn't sound so part-time.
No, it's not part-time at all. In fact, I probably spend 60 to 80 hours a week, and the people like myself who are adjuncts get put in the most labor-intensive courses, and because I teach English, I have tons of papers to grade, many hours spent trying to prepare. I certainly went to good schools. I went to the University of Chicago, Berkeley, and McGill. And for that, I require food stamps for my family. I require the HEAP subsidy and subsidy for daycare for my 5-year-old.
Wow. I mean,
and it's a desperate situation. And the fact is that the higher education in New York State is doing exactly what business are doing. We're shedding what were once lectureships and replacing them with adjuncts like myself. And now, of course, Governor Cuomo wants us to increase the amount that we have to pay for premiums for health care. And we're the poorest segment of the public employees. And
so you feel yourself sliding on the wage scale. But let me ask you, I mean, and that is a tough story. And, you know, full sympathy right there. But it's a free country. Maybe you're in the wrong field, you know? Maybe you should...
Well, that would be a nice comforting thought, except there's two problems with it. The first one is, this summer when I was unemployed, and of course I'm not eligible for unemployment as an academic employee, even though our contracts stipulate that we're temporary and part-time.
Yep.
And realize, again, we're talking about 40 to 70% of the undergraduate course load being taught by people just like
me. No, I got it. We got it.
Yeah, but what's difficult is, I'm in my 50s now, and I tried to even get waiting jobs, and no one wanted to hire a 50-year-old waiter. I applied for camp counselor jobs. I applied for any kind of part-time work, and I live in rural America. I live in the Adirondacks.
Yep.
It cost me $12 to $15 a day in gasoline to get to my campus. But the other problem is I'm so poor now because of this. I make less than I did when I was unemployed and was earning unemployment because I lost a full-time position. I can't afford to move. Because our wages now are so small that we can't put together first and last month to move. I can't afford moving costs. And because we did accumulate some things when I had an income, we're shedding them right and left. And yet the higher education has now become an engine of inequality that reflects the economy at large.
Richard, it's a hard, hard story. And if you can't even move, you become a kind of a wage slave right there where you are. Let us pick it up. I appreciate your call. And I wish you good luck. Paul Osterman, what do you hear?
Well, so the story that Richard tells is a story that, as he says, is true throughout the economy. Jobs have been degraded. The average worker earns virtually no more than he or she did 25 years ago. But, you know, that quote by Bill Gross, he says that we're heading in an international economy. We may have to accept this. That implies we don't have choices. Well, in the last 15 years, productivity in America has gone up, but virtually all of the gains of that productivity have gone to people in Bill Gross's wage level or slightly below. That's a choice. That's not inevitable. This kind of notion that we have to accept this kind of story that Richard tells, that is inevitable, that international pressures are requiring us to accept it, that's just not right. We have choices if we're willing to make them.
Let's go to Ben in Omaha, Nebraska. Ben, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am very concerned that the talk about job creation is not paired with our education system enough. In the last 20 years, our education system has become so lax. I think that this downgrade is just, I mean, do we even have the willpower and possibility of spreading the economy? We used to have people that come up with innovative ideas as a result of the best education in the world. Now we certainly do not have that. And I fear that everybody's just focused on these short-term gains in job growth when really we need to entirely revamp our education system. And we look at improvements like decades from now.
Well, there's a lot of talk about that, of course, and has been for years, and yet we're waiting for that big improvement. Don Baylor, what about the Texas example there? A lot of job creation, but that portion at the low end, how does it tie in with education policy in Texas? Now they may have a tough challenge because, again, they're on the border. They've got a lot of bilingual students or maybe students who don't have English. I don't know how big a challenge that is for Texas. But how does Texas talk about it? How does Rick Perry talk about it as a path to boosting that low end of the wage scale?
Well, unfortunately, even though our organization and Opportunity Texas talks a lot about how education is the great equalizer, especially public education, we don't necessarily hear a lot of that rhetoric necessarily in Texas. It seems as if K-12 education spending is something that the legislature has to do and not necessarily wants to do. We cut $4 billion out of education during this last budget. Even though we have the largest, fastest growing child population in the U.S. And so we are not making the types of investments that will yield a more educated workforce in the future.
Erica,
we're just not.
Erica, what about the choices then? I mean, is it making choices? Has it made choices that produce this wage profile? You hear Paul Osterman says, as a country, we can make choices and go the other way. Do you believe it?
Yeah. One of the interesting things is you've mentioned this factor about being on the border a couple of times. And one thing I find sort of striking and kind of weird, actually, about Texas mm-hmm. politicians, including Perry, is they very rarely make that argument. You won't catch them citing the bilingual population, for example, as a cause of poverty or poor outcomes in the state. So I think that's kind of a notable feature.
Is that avoidance or is that just accurate the way they're portraying it or not?
I'm not sure what it is. It strikes me as kind of weird. I think they just consider it as not a thing that should be engaged with. So for example, this is true of Bush too. He instituted a policy in Texas when he was governor that if you were in the top 10% of your high school graduating class, you could go to any public university or you were guaranteed admission, which is
right.
Actually a good policy. But it was kind of meant as a dodge, I think, of affirmative action questions because they just didn't want to engage that question.
Was it paid for or you just got admission?
You just got admission.
Mm-hmm.
And actually that ended up being kind of a more successful than they expected because everyone was super excited about it and very motivated to go to university. And so at UT here in Austin, where Don and I are based, they can actually only let in the top 6% of the class because everyone wants to go to Texas. But as far as state policy, I wanted to quickly point out one thing that Paul said that I really agree with, mm-hmm. which is that there is a lot we can do, I think, in this country through workforce training and through sort of well-planned efforts to match the workforce in a state or in a region with the industries that are growing and that have potential to grow.
Paul, what about that and Texas' position on the border? You know, Erica doesn't hear a lot of talk about that. On the other hand, look at a map. There it is. And you can't help but think that it's part of this may be, especially in your Rio Grande Valley where you were, the proximity to an economy with a lower wage base right across the border, pulling wages down there.
Well, that's right. But you know, again, that living wage campaign I described raised wages. The job training programs that I mentioned, that Erica just mentioned, have succeeded in getting people into those much better jobs. So again, there's choice. Let me make a kind of an ironical point here.
Mm-hmm.
With unemployment at 9%, the president's proposed a plan to boost investment. He has kind of gone halfway. We need more investment. But there's this kind of anti-government feeling. Government spending is bad.
Right.
So you go down to San Antonio, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
The Riverwalk is
beautiful.
A beautiful walk.
Mm-hmm.
It's an important tourist draw to San Antonio.
Absolutely.
It's a source of jobs in San Antonio. It was built by the Works Progress Administration under Franklin Roosevelt during the Depression. It was government employment investment during an economic crisis that built the Riverwalk, but it was a real investment in the future of that city, and it paid off. And so, again, at the in terms of the macro problem, the 9% unemployment, even there, we still have choices if we're willing to make them.
San Antonio's still benefiting from that. I mean, it is beautiful, and as you say, it draws people to San Antonio. Jerry in Wrentham, Massachusetts. Jerry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm questioning how many of these new jobs in Texas are actually new jobs and not jobs that migrated from higher wage states down to Texas to take advantage of these lower wages.
Let me see if our panel knows the answer to that. Erica, let me come first to you. Do you know?
With regard to Texas in the past 2 years, I think if you look at net job creation in Texas, it's about 300,000. As I said, if you look at Texas's share of net job creation among only the states that created jobs, so i.e. not the states that lost jobs to Texas or anyone else, I think that would put the figure at about 260,000.
But is this, Paul, is this internal offshoring? Is this higher wage jobs migrating to Texas for lower pay?
There's certainly some of that. For example, I know a case in Austin where they're using tax breaks to lure a company. But really, Texas—
Lots of states do that.
Lots of states. Mm-hmm. Texas does have a couple of natural advantages. It is on the border, and so in the Rio Grande Valley that we talked about, tons of people come across the border from Mexico to shop. That creates retail jobs in Texas.
And you've got all the NAFTA factories across the border.
Texas has benefited from NAFTA. Texas has benefited from the fact that there's oil in the ground. So I think a lot of the job creation, and Don may know this better, I'm sure he knows this better than I do, is legitimate. It's not just stealing workers from other parts of the country.
Jeff in Evansville, Indiana. Jeff, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Great show, great station. I listen to it all the time.
Great.
Two or three quick points. I think Tom Friedman is right in his book, his recent book, That Used to Be Us. This program, although extremely valuable and the discussion is great, if we're down to talking about basically low-wage America, we're actually heading in the direction of poor America. And what that'll happen to, what that will create is a market that no longer can sustain any producing job, whether they produce goods in China or elsewhere. If we're all poor in America, they'll have to write us off as a market. So corporate America has to understand that if all it cares about is paying its workers lower wages, they're cutting their arm off, because America is the number one consumer in the world.
The market. And if the market goes away, what do we end up with? I mean, I take your point absolutely. We're going to be talking with Tom Friedman about his new book, Jeff. But Paul Osterman, is it really, maybe we're too worried about low wages. Maybe when the economy turns around, the wages turn around too. You know, the sort of feeling that, oh my gosh, we may be locked on a conveyor belt toward, you know, the dismal swamp of low wages. Is it so?
No, full employment is a piece of the answer, but it's not the answer. So in the 1990s, from 1992 to 2000, we had this enormous boom in the labor market. It was the best period in probably my lifetime and your lifetime in terms of jobs. The fraction of people who held these poverty-level jobs fell from about 1992. Again, it was something like 20% down to about 17%, the fraction of adults. Full employment helped, but far from solved the problem. We really have to make some real decisions about how we feel about education and training, how we feel about employment standards, how we feel about employee voice. These are real choices. We cannot rely on full employment to solve the problem. It's necessary, but it's not sufficient.
Don, how do you think this plays out in Texas, in the country looking at Texas? People are starving for jobs. Rick Perry made jobs by hook or by crook, one way or another. Do you think that ultimately redounds to his favor in the national conversation here?
Well, it's interesting. I think some of that crowing may have actually worked to our disadvantage in Texas. So during the recession, we added in population, working age population, more than Washington, D.C. So we added close to 1 million working age folks.
Because people came to Texas looking for those jobs in part.
In part. Mm-hmm. And so as I've said before, we may have created 250,000 jobs over the past couple of years, but our unemployment rate has risen by almost a point, And the number of jobs that we need to create to get back to full employment has gone from 400,000 to 600,000. So even though we have a lot of job quantity, there are actually more and more people looking for work, and there are more and more people looking for work that have been out of work for more than 6 months. So, you know, there's not necessarily any model or miracle that we should be trying to emulate at the national level.
Erica, we've just got half a minute. What would you look to Texas for? What would you not look to it for when it comes to the jobs crisis in this country?
I think there are a few general points we can extrapolate from the Texas example. So one is try to keep your economy diversified before you get there. Don't get too heavy in construction or anything else. We had that advantage going into the recession. Another one is if you're going to spend state money, which you know states will do, think intelligently about how you can do it to build industries, perhaps capital-intensive ones that are going to stick around for a while. I think wind industry or wind power is a good example of that in Texas. And I think there is some value to the idea of being clear about what you're planning to do with regard to job creation before you start doing it, whether that's the conservative tort reform approach or a more progressive, workforce-focused approach.
Because I guess, as everyone says today, there are choices to be made here, and to the extent we can, they're sitting right in front of us. Erica Greeter with The Economist, thank you so much for joining us from Austin today.
Of course, thank you.
Don Baylor, thanks for being here, and Paul Osterman with MIT's Sloan School of Management, thanks to you both. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.